Hi, I'm Asha Tomlinson.
And I'm David Common.
And we're hosts of CBC Marketplace. We're award-winning investigative journalists that want to help you avoid clever scams, unsafe products, and sketchy services.
Our TV show has been Canada's top investigative consumer watchdog for more than 50 years, but this is our first podcast.
CBC Marketplace podcast is available now on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Nora Young. This is Spark and our special series, The Butterfly Effect. A central idea of chaos theory is that changes to initial conditions of a system will affect its outcomes. There's a classic metaphor for illustrating this. Something as small as a butterfly flapping its wings on one side of the ocean can lead to a tornado on the other side. In other words, a seemingly minor action can set a system on a massively different course of events. And that's what we're focusing on in this series. Over the course of 10 episodes, we'll look at small inventions that have gone on to change the world, so much so that it's hard to imagine what life would be like without them. Welcome to The Butterfly Effect. As far as modern household appliances go, they don't get much more basic than the humble refrigerator. Almost every single household in North America has at least one. And there they sit, day after day, keeping your perishable food fresh and ready to eat. They become so commonplace that most of us probably don't give them a second thought. So it's easy to forget what a huge impact they had when they were first introduced over 100 years ago. For thousands of years, humans have known colder temperatures will keep food edible for longer. Long, long before the invention of the refrigerator, people came up with all sorts of ingenious inventions and techniques, and most of them involved storing ice. The ancient Persians built giant stone domes and ventilation towers that took advantage of the region's arid climate to store ice and provide air conditioning. The Romans and the ancient Chinese knew that adding saltpeter to water would rapidly drop its temperature, a technique that was later used in the Renaissance to popularize ice cream in Europe. But
America founded the ice industry?
That's right. The story of modern refrigeration begins in the early days of the United States.
My name's Jonathan Reese. I'm a professor of history at Colorado State University, Pueblo, and I've written 3 books about the American refrigeration industry. In terms of turning it into an industry, there's a guy named Frederick Tudor in 1806. He was a Massachusetts merchant, and he realized that the ice in New England that freezes every winter was itself a commodity. So he started selling it in the southern United States and the Caribbean, and he sent it as far away as India. That's the beginning of the American ice industry.
And so they were essentially harvesting the ice from the natural environment. Is that right?
Yes. And in fact, it looked very much like a plow, except instead of furrowing the ground, you would cut the ice. It's a little more complicated than that. But if you saw pictures of, you know, the old New England ice industry, other than the fact that the horse was on a lake, it was the dead of winter, it wouldn't seem that very different than any other kind of agriculture. So they took it out of the lake, they put it in the ice house for the winter, and then in the summer, they'll send it to the warm places in the earth. The question you were about to ask was, how did they keep it from melting? And they didn't. But the outside ice in a big block of ice insulates the inside ice in a big block of ice. And so you'll still have some left even months later.
I understand that Americans in particular had an early love of ice for drinks, for example.
Yeah, it was deliberately cultivated by people like Tudor. Tudor gave the ice away to bars in order to get people hooked on ice. And then the second year he would start charging. That's how he created a taste for ice and profit for himself.
Meanwhile, as Americans were developing this taste for ice, scientists were getting closer to understanding the nature of matter, how heat actually worked, and how cold was just the absence of heat. Attributing the invention of the refrigerator to any one person is no easy task. Everyone from Michael Faraday to Albert Einstein worked on the science behind it. For this episode, we found our own scientist to help us with some basics.
So my name is Drew Lilly. I am a researcher in the refrigeration space. I work at Lawrence Berkeley National Labs, and I'm finishing up my PhD in mechanical engineering.
So can you explain to me exactly how the refrigerator in my kitchen works to keep things cold?
Yes. So it uses a liquid to vapor transition.
Okay. This system is called vapor compression. It's based on the fact that when matter changes states, it either absorbs or releases a lot of energy. Vapor compression is also based on an important discovery scientists made about gases. Increasing their pressure increases their temperature, and vice versa.
And the pressure is modulated by what's called a compressor. So that's probably the louder noise you might hear sometime. And so you modulate a liquid to vapor transition using a compressor to control the pressure.
A refrigerant in a closed system is forced by that compressor through a condenser. This liquid is then forced through an expansion valve and into an evaporator, where it becomes a vapor.
You basically take that liquid and you put it in a coil that's facing the inside of your refrigerator. And then through some means, you say, okay, liquid, become vapor. The liquid says, well, I need energy. And so then it looks to your refrigerator and says, you have energy. I'm going to steal it from you. Steals the energy, making the inside of the fridge cold, and then becomes a vapor. And then you want to regenerate that, right? So to continue the cycle.
The vaporized refrigerant is then circulated back to the compressor, where it gets compressed back into a liquid and sheds that excess energy off into the environment.
And so it releases all that energy and becomes a liquid again.
Which is why you'll always feel warm air coming from either the back or the side of your fridge.
Yes, it's impossible to make something cold without making something else hot. So you'll always feel heat coming out the back of your fridge or the back of your air conditioner.
We'll have more with Drew Lilly a little later in the show to talk about how he and other scientists are researching alternatives to the standard vapor compression cycle. It's an attempt to make it more environmentally friendly. But back to the past for a bit, because it's a long way from early cooling technology experiments to the domestic fridge that sits in your kitchen. Here's historian Jonathan Rees.
As early as the 1860s, there's a lot of experimentation with regard to, for instance, what the right refrigerant is in particular circumstances, and to how to mass produce a refrigerator becomes very difficult. I was talking about giant refrigeration plants, and that's sort of the first commercial version of that. And that's almost an exclusively American thing in the late 19th and very early 20th centuries. And in fact, a lot of those first plants are used to chill water in order to make ice, in order to make refrigeration more accessible to lots of other people, because they could only do it on this gigantic scale. These machines are about the size of a warehouse in many cases. And so that's sort of the first really big American dip into the refrigeration business. Shrinking that was very difficult. So you had to switch refrigerants, and that's from about 1915 to 1925. And then that's the thing that spreads all around the world. And indeed, lots of other countries influence the development of refrigeration. But in terms of making money off of the United States pioneers it.
So just to go back to those large refrigerating plants, so they would produce ice, and then that the ice would then go into people's ice boxes in their homes? Is that what it was used for?
Yes. The ice would be cut into blocks, sold off to ice companies, loaded on the back of a wagon, and carried all around the city. And almost every city in America had access to ice. It's very popular. Again, at the same time, a lot of places in the United States would cut the ice out of rivers. Mm. But in the late 19th century, what was known as artificial ice gradually begins to replace natural ice, and that becomes much more prevalent and cheaper. And also, ironically, the artificial stuff is cleaner, which makes it much better if you're going to drop it into your drink. If you had an iced drink in about 1870, chances are it would be natural ice, and there's a very good chance you'd find dirt at the bottom of your glass once it was done. But that's not the case if that ice is made by one of those ice machines.
And what had to happen in order for those for it to become practical to make refrigerants at a domestic scale as opposed to these very large plants?
Yeah, there was a lot of obstacles to this. It's worth noting that everybody realized that you could make a fortune if you could invent a functional home refrigerator, because there's this huge market for ice. Even the poorest Americans bought ice and kept it in their bathtubs. So if you could get a functional home refrigerator, everybody would want one. But you had to be able to shrink the machine down so that that compression system will work in a small space. That required experimenting with new refrigerants. They eventually settled on something which we now know today is Freon. You had to make it mass producible because you couldn't sell an expensive refrigerator to everyone. So a lot of car companies, believe it or not, got into the refrigeration business in the 20s. Huh. You had to make it quiet because nobody wanted a huge racket in their kitchen all the time. Lots of different obstacles. You had to make it safe. Some of the early refrigerants were actually poisonous gases. So there are terrible refrigerator disasters periodically in the 20s from people who were poisoned by their home appliances.
Wow.
Yeah.
So at what point did we finally land on the technology that we see in our household refrigerators today?
Really, it's 1927. If you had one of those early General Motors refrigerators, it would be no different. Then, well, there are more bells and whistles on your modern refrigerator, you know, like the light inside. Mm. But in terms of keeping food cold, the only difference between it and the modern refrigerator is that it's smaller.
Anyone care for a spot of grapefruit juice to tide you over?
Yeah.
Incidentally, one of the things I love about this refrigerator is that it turns out ice circles and puts them in a bowl for you. All by itself. Continuous ice circles.
Yeah? Really?
I'm Nora Young. This is Spark. Today on our occasional series, The Butterfly Effect, we're looking at the impact of refrigeration on society. We just heard historian Jonathan Rees talk about how the basic refrigerator technology we have today goes back to around 1927. So what did the people think of this revolutionary new tech at the time?
Oh, everybody loved it. It's just an absolutely revolutionary technology. It is absolutely paradigm shifting. It makes it possible to defy seasons for the first time. Mm. I think that's the most shocking thing to the people who were around in the early 20th century. Apples are a seasonal food. Eggs are a seasonal food. All these things that used to be seasonal are no longer seasonal because you can keep them in your refrigerator or you can keep them in cold storage, which is just a big refrigerator plant. And the people who produce those perishable foods just start improving the supply because it cuts waste and then selling them all throughout the year. So it's just a huge change in people's diets.
Who were the first people to adopt this new technology?
On the consumer side, it's rich people because the first refrigerators are extraordinarily expensive. You actually had to, for some of these models, you had to cut a hole in your kitchen floor and put the machinery in the basement and have the refrigerator upstairs.
Wow.
Only rich people could afford that. And even those refrigerators aren't particularly good at what they do. They hadn't worked out all the problems yet. But once you have it in sort of a self-contained box, then we're really off to the races.
Were there any kinds of concerns that people had about refrigeration technology?
Oh, absolutely. That one, that would poison them.
Sure.
The other is that the people who were using refrigeration to sort of hold some of that perishable food back so they could be stretched out along the year were price gouging them.
Mm.
They thought that this was just a way to manipulate prices. And of course, refrigeration affects freshness. Americans are a little refrigeration crazy. And because of that, we aren't quite as attuned to the freshness of our food, I think, as a lot of other people are around the world. Mm. And so there is an initial concern that, you know, refrigerated eggs taste a little different. The refrigerated apples taste a little different. But eventually access to the apples, at least in the United States, won out over whatever concerns you have about taste.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that because it seems like, yes, it does extend the variety of food that you can have, but in a way, does it also prioritize, you know, the kinds of produce, for example, that lasts well in the refrigerator or that kind of thing? Is there a trade-off there?
It does. One of my favorite examples of this is iceberg lettuce, the very sort of strong but weak tasting lettuce that shows up in sort of salad plates at medium expensive restaurants who just want to throw in a salad. That is invented in the first decade of the 20th century and is invented solely because it can stand up to ice when it's being shipped from California to the rest of the country. So it is a product that's bred entirely for refrigeration as opposed to taste. But, you know, being able to have lettuce anytime you wanted was a good thing. So people went with it.
The refrigerator was clearly on its way to becoming a hit with American families. But no one could have predicted the extent to which it was about to change their entire relationship with food forever.
I'm Nicola Twilley. I'm co-host of Gastropod Podcast and the author of the forthcoming book about refrigeration, The Birth of Cool. Back in sort of 2010, 11, there was a lot of talk of farm to table, and I started to think about where was food traveling in between farm and table. And I realized we had built this vast artificial Arctic for our food to live in.
You know, I'd never thought much about refrigeration beyond the appliance in the kitchen and the coolers in the supermarket. But today's food systems rely on what's called a cold chain.
So the refrigerator you have in your kitchen is the tip of the iceberg. I mean, literally. The cold chain extends from the farm, where produce is pre-cooled, or from the slaughterhouse, where, you know, the slaughter takes place under refrigeration, all the way to the store where you buy it. Everything from the initial pre-cooling, so to bring down, say, a lamb that is at its body temperature, or a tomato that has been in the field and has field heat, you want to bring all that heat out of it, bring it down to the temperature it wants to be at. Then you're going to transport it in a refrigerated truck or a refrigerated rail car. Then you're going to store it under some kind of refrigeration. And then you're going to distribute it again, once again in refrigerated transport. And it's going to go into a supermarket retail case. And often that will be chilled too, although not necessarily in the case of produce.
The expansive produce department offers a choice selection of the freshest grown fruits and vegetables available.
So let's go back to the early 20th century. Electric refrigerators are just starting to take off in North America. How did that start to change the relationship that people had with their food?
It's a really interesting time because today we take this technology so for granted that I think people think food isn't fresh or safe if it hasn't been refrigerated. And the exact reverse was true. At the turn of the 20th century, refrigerated food was suspect. So previously, you had known if something was fresh because it had to be from a certain distance away, had to have been harvested within a certain window of time. It was visually sort of evident to you. There was sort of a known physics of freshness almost.
Mm-hmm.
And refrigeration totally changed that because suddenly you could put eggs, for example, in cold storage, springtime eggs, sell them in September as freshly laid eggs, and no one could tell. No one knew the difference. So there was a fear that refrigerated food wasn't fresh, and there was a suspicion that people were using it to manipulate prices, which sometimes they were. There was also a lack of understanding of exactly how cold worked and what it could do. So there was a lot of sort of optimism from merchants who would say, this chicken's about to turn. Let me refrigerate it. it will slow decay, but it doesn't reverse decay. So there was also sort of a lot of, I didn't sell this today. It's on the turn. I'll refrigerate it. And that gave refrigerated foods a bad reputation too.
Refrigeration, as I understand it, was adopted much more quickly in North America than it was in Europe or other places around the world. Why do you think that was?
I think it's because of that marketing. And I think some of that's just general tendency towards convenience and a willingness to give up on taste. I think it's worth noting that Canadians are right behind the United States when it comes to refrigeration. They, like the rest of the world, they sort of skip the warehouse stage of things, but they quickly adopted refrigerators right after the United States.
In space, they keep the sub-zero temperatures outside the capsules. But here in this new food freezer, cold temperature is welcome. And the zero zone inside keeps the frozen food safe until they're needed.
The supermarket is also tied in with the rise of the suburbs post-war and everyone having a car and so on. So it's all part of a parcel. But yes, once you have supermarkets and supermarkets have invested in refrigerated display cases and freezer cabinets and so on, people are doing a bulk shop. So then they're driving to a supermarket and they're putting it in their refrigerator at home that they now have, because otherwise they would need to shop every day because you can't store it overnight. Or if they had an ice box and it was smaller and not as reliable, again, you wouldn't be storing it. You would be shopping every day. That weekly shop wouldn't make sense. It wouldn't make sense to have such a big store that you drive to and then do a big, big shop. So everything sort of is a self-fulfilling, self-reinforcing cycle there. And what's interesting about it is that in some countries, for example, France, where there was a sense that these big supermarkets were going to do what they did here, which is hollow out town centers and leave the old walkable downtowns empty because people weren't doing their food shopping there, and sort of put smaller shops, the butchers, the greengrocers, etc., out of business, which they did. In France, where that was sort of seen as a threat because France refrigerated a little later than the US, they put regulations in place on the size of supermarkets and managed to save a lot of their downtowns and a lot of their independent shops. And people in France to this day have domestic refrigerators that are about half the size of American ones because they aren't shopping for a week or 2 weeks at a time.
Based on my research, Americans have the largest refrigerators in the world. Canadians have the second largest refrigerators in the world. Huh. A lot of them are, you know, American models, some of them produced in Canada, some of them not. But it's because they have that same general tendency, just to a slightly lesser degree.
There's simply nothing like it. Across the top and behind its own separate door, a completely separate food freezer that holds 84 pounds of frozen foods. In addition to three ice cube trays, there is an extra tray for frozen desserts.
So how did it change the agricultural side of the equation?
So refrigeration has utterly transformed where food is grown. Again, once you can refrigerate food, you can manipulate not only time, so how much time you have to consume it, but also space. So how far away that food can be from a consumer and still make it to them. So one of the earliest refrigerated fruits was the banana. People don't think of a banana as a refrigerated fruit because you don't put it in your fridge at home. But in fact, we could not eat bananas if we couldn't transport them under refrigeration because they would rot before they made it to us. And so it is sort of the ultimate refrigerated fruit. And the banana has gone from being a thing that, you know, Abraham Lincoln never saw one. People wrote articles in Scientific American in the, you know, in the early 1900s saying, wow, this fabulous fruit would be such an amazing addition to our diet if only we could find a way. And then by a decade later, with the advances in refrigeration, you get a Boy Scout guide suggesting pick up a banana peel as a good deed, because there were so many. And with that, of course, comes the development of an entire banana economy in a part of the world that has never had that, Central America, which, as we know, then sort of that dependence on an export crop and how it was backed up by the U.S. government led to sort of banana republics and all the political and economic implications of that. So that's just one example of sort of really how the ability to move food from where it was grown to where the eaters were transformed everything from what we were eating to the politics of an entire region.
Yeah. Are there other examples of that sort of political dimension of refrigerated agriculture?
One thing that is very interesting is that refrigerated trucking in the U.S. was exempt from regulation deliberately as an anti-union move. It was sort of a government exemption that was designed to keep food cheap, keep rural sort of folks who didn't have farm jobs now that farms were industrializing, you know, refrigerated trucking of agricultural produce was a sort of, if you were the second son and you weren't going to inherit the farm, there weren't jobs for everybody, you could do that. And at the same time, by not regulating it, the U.S. government was sort of able to really diminish the influence of the Teamsters, one of the most powerful unions, over in general and over the food supply. So it has been used. I mean, really, food is so central to everything that governments kind of resist using it politically. You know, you see it even with the price of things. You know, China will have a pork reserve. Well, you can't do that without refrigeration. But that's there so that prices don't get too high and people get too unhappy about the price of pork. So they stockpile it.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share 2 hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Nora Young, and today on Spark, the 8th installment of our occasional series, The Butterfly Effect, all about refrigeration and how the ability to create cold on demand changed our relationship with food forever. We've been hearing from Nicola Twilley, a journalist, podcast host, and author of an upcoming book on refrigeration, as well as historian Jonathan Rees, who has written 3 books on refrigeration. When electrical fridges launched in the early 20th century, it kicked off a series of massive transformations to the North American food system, and eventually the world. In the early 1930s, only 8% of American households had refrigerators. By the end of the 1940s, that number was 44%. Today, that number is more than 99%, and many households now have more than one. But according to Nicola Twilley, the widespread adoption of refrigeration has not been without consequences.
On the one hand, you have what the externalities of refrigeration. So the fact that it allows you to scale up and concentrate, that means that you have concentrated feeding lots for animals. Those create pollution, etc. Similarly, with refrigerated trucks and the fact that refrigerated warehouses will often concentrate in particular neighborhoods, logistics hubs, and the air pollution there has its own burden. So there's sort of that whole environmental cost. Looking at refrigeration more directly, there's either 2 things going on there. The first thing is refrigerants themselves. This is the liquid that is running around in tubes, pulling the heat out of the space, out of the truck, out of the warehouse. So these refrigerants have their own environmental impact. In the past, the refrigerant used in your domestic fridge was likely Freon, which, as we all now know, was causing a hole in the ozone layer that is still not healed. But we don't use Freon anymore. Sadly, it turns out that its replacements, which are gases called HFCs for the most part, are what are known as super greenhouse gases. It's like 1,000 times more warming than CO2, several thousand times more warming than CO2. And you might think, well, that's not a problem unless you release it. But unfortunately, all refrigeration systems leak a little or sometimes a lot to the atmosphere. Plus, there's end of life and capturing it at end of life, which doesn't always happen. So that's one issue, and it's a really big one. To give you a sense of how big it is, Project Drawdown, which is this sort of assessment of what are the most effective things or impactful things we could be doing to mitigate climate change, rates refrigerant management as its number one most important thing for us to be doing. So then you have the energy used to run the refrigeration machinery, and that adds up to an awful lot as well, an increasing amount, in fact, because the rest of the world is on its way to building a US-style cold chain that will use an awful lot of electricity. And you might think, well, we could just green that. What if it all runs on wind? And that is a great idea, but currently our investments in renewables are not even keeping pace with our own demand. So that's an issue. The other place where refrigeration really touches on climate change is food waste. So food waste is a huge source of methane, especially when it's buried in landfill rather than being composted. And so if food rots without oxygen, it releases methane. That is terrible. Leaving aside the fact that you've spent all this water and land and fertilizer to grow the food that you've thrown away, the justification for investing in refrigeration is to prevent food waste. The evidence seems to show that refrigeration actually just changes where the waste occurs. So in countries that don't have a good cold chain, the waste occurs on the farm and getting the food to market and at market. In the developed world, the waste occurs at home in our own refrigerators. And in some senses, actually, our refrigerators are a little bit to blame. We have these big, big refrigerators. Things get lost in them. And in people's head, there's this sort of safety net of refrigeration where things are going to stay good in there until suddenly they're not and you have to toss them. So there's a sense, especially common among, you know, American shoppers, that a full fridge is important. There's a security to having that and a sense of well-being and abundance. But if you fill an American-sized fridge, I mean, good luck to you getting through that. There's a lot of space in there for food. So when you look at statistics, basically they say 40% of food is wasted before it gets to market in the developing world. And then in the developed world, we throw away between 30 and 40%. So refrigeration seems to sort of just switch where it happens, not prevent it.
In the latter part of the 20th century, we start to see the introduction of the refrigerated rail car and the refrigerated modular shipping container. Can you talk to me a bit about the implications that had for the global food system?
Oh, absolutely. It makes it much more complicated. It is now financially viable to catch fish off the Pacific coast of the United States, ship that fish via a shipping container to China for deboning, and then ship it all the way back to the United States to sell as frozen fish fillets. And that simply never could have happened. It helps reduce the price of everything. Again, there is a sacrifice in taste for being able to have that sort of thing. But it is a tremendous asset to people who are looking for the cheapest food.
You've done some reporting, for example, in China and Rwanda that looks at, you know, in places where refrigeration and the cold chain is just sort of getting underway. Can you tell me a bit more about that and like some of the impacts both of not refrigerating, but also of the coming refrigeration boom?
Yeah, so this is really interesting because, you know, for the U.S., we're talking about, and North America in general, much of the developed world, we're talking about something that happened several generations ago, is now internalized as the way we handle food. But in a lot of the world, that's not true yet. And so if you're interested in understanding the impact of refrigeration, which was my goal, you can go to places that haven't refrigerated yet, like Rwanda, which is set itself a goal to build a cold chain and is just now getting underway. Or you can go to places where they've set that goal. The government in China made building a cold chain part of its 12th five-year plan and is now well down that road, and you can start seeing the effects it has. And so what's interesting about that is you can start to tease out what is sort of common to the refrigerated experience around the world. In China, for example, you can already see increased consumption of meat, increased consumption of dairy, which is also interesting as a majority lactose intolerant population. You can see the shift in diet to pre-prepared foods, frozen foods, convenience foods, the rise of branding of food. Once you can store it and ship it, it can become a brand that is available. This is how we end up with branded fruits, for example, you know. You can see those things start to happen. In Rwanda, what's so interesting is the only way for farmers to really afford refrigeration is to grow crops for export. And so that's an interesting thing where that's bringing in much needed income. But on the other hand, it's also sort of just supplying cheap vegetables for former colonial powers, which is, you know, not perhaps ideal, and comes with its own implications too. One of the researchers I spoke to in Rwanda was telling me that, you know, once a dairy farming family had the ability to refrigerate their milk, they no longer gave the evening milk to the children because they could save it and send it to market the next day and get some money for it. And so she was saying to me, you might think, well, nutrition would definitely go up. Childhood malnutrition would go down once you put refrigeration in. But that's not necessarily the case because the family also, maybe they have a leaky roof they have to repair. Maybe they need to get a mobile phone so they can, you know, sell their milk at market, etc. And so it has these implications that people don't see coming.
And it's had other unexpected consequences here in North America, too. The refrigerator opened up new possibilities, not just in what people could eat and when. It also meant they could keep food fresher for longer without resorting to age-old preservation techniques like salting, pickling, or fermenting. But it's not entirely clear yet whether that's been a change for the better.
Fruit and vegetables that weren't able to be cold stored didn't make it. So varieties of apples that are not very storable, that really only last 3 months in storage, we don't see them on the shelves anymore. Similarly, in choosing varieties that were more storable, we've actually lost flavor. So one of the people I look at in my book has been working on tomatoes and what went so horribly wrong with tomatoes. I mean, we all know that supermarket tomatoes,
yeah,
they're not all that. So, and the reason for that is because in selecting for something that could be harvested green, refrigerated, shipped, and then gassed with ethylene to ripen, the genes for maximum flavor were lost. They didn't have to be. It was a sort of, the breeders just weren't breeding for that. And so he has spent 20 years trying to breed those back into the commercial varieties. But so a supermarket tomato, even if you left it on the vine and let it ripen in the sun, it was never going to taste that great because it has lost the genes that bring the great flavors that we love in good tomatoes. So that's a sort of weird way that refrigeration has done that. We definitely, when you look at statistics overall, people do eat more fresh fruit now than they did. People eat more meat than they did, and dairy. Vegetable consumption statistics are funny because people just didn't bother collecting them. Only the potato counted as real food, I guess. So our salad leaf consumption may well have gone up, but we don't really have the data to say that. We've reduced our consumption, though, on the other hand, of fermented foods. And increasingly, of course, we know that those have health benefits. So it's a really interesting and really mixed bag. And when you, I have a section in my book where I kind of try to tease out, was this a net benefit or not to our health? And that is extremely complicated and very unresolved.
So roomy, so versatile, newly styled too with a new special seal that keeps fruits and vegetables salad crisp and garden fresh every day of the week. Yes. address, the coal pantry for 1957. Food freezers, big, roomy, beautiful. America's handiest refrigerators, perfectly planned food storage, unmatched anywhere.
There's one big refrigerator change in the last 100 years. Came in 1957. It's the frost-free refrigerator. Before 1957, you had to like periodically clear out your refrigerator and let all the frost that ended up on some of the machinery just melt so that it wouldn't break down. And that was a big pain. And they managed in 1957 to come up with a technology that will melt it for you as you go so that you never have to do that again. That was a big deal. Nothing else was really particularly important.
Jonathan Rees is an author and a professor of history at Colorado State University.
Now to put the finishing touches on the dessert for Susan's party this afternoon. One moment when you might say she had her hands full. But design engineers have anticipated such occasions, for this new refrigerator has an electric door. Just a touch is all that's needed.
So here we are. We built a global food system that is utterly dependent on mechanical refrigeration. But as that system continues to grow, it's harder to ignore its massive environmental impacts. So in the world of refrigeration science, the race is on to create new tech that can mitigate those impacts. Remember Drew Lilly, the researcher who explained how your fridge works?
Nora, hello.
He's one of those scientists.
And my goal is to decarbonize refrigeration and how we make things cold and how we make things hot as well.
Drew's PhD thesis is about creating a new type of refrigeration cycle that he and his team call ionocaloric cooling. Unlike today's vapor compression refrigeration, this technology relies on changing between solid and liquid using salt.
The vapor compression cycle, one of the reasons it's so successful is because when you go from a liquid to a vapor, you need a lot of energy, right? It's like a massive amount of energy to do that. But the downside is that, you know, vapors are hard to contain and they always leak. So it turns out that the solid to liquid transition actually has almost a very comparable amount of energy that, you know, it absorbs. But, you know, solids and liquids don't really go anywhere. You could kind of just drop them in a bucket and not under pressure or anything like that. If we want to make a refrigerator out of the cycle, you would take a solid instead of a liquid.
Okay.
And we would tell the solid to become a liquid. The solid says, I got to grab energy from somewhere. And so if you point it, you know, in the direction of the spot you want to make cold, and you say, okay, I'll steal the energy from you.
Okay.
And then you make it cold. And then to restart the cooling cycle, once we have a liquid, maybe we point it, you know, in the outside of your refrigerator, and we tell the liquid to become a solid again. And same thing happens. It says, well, I got to get rid of all this excess energy. And so then it releases it, or it dumps it to the outside of your refrigerator. So analogous to pressure, you know, in the vapor compression, we use literally salt. So in science-y terms, it's called an electrochemical field. We can change its desire to be a liquid or solid by changing the salt content. You know, if you take ice, we know that if you throw some salt on it, you lower the melting point. And so what we do is we modulate the concentration of salt that is interfacing with the liquid or the material. And that will coerce the material to exist as a solid or a liquid.
So tell me if I've got this right. There's these two different things. Instead of the compression, expansion, pressure, vacuum idea, you're manipulating the concentration of salt to change the melting point. And also, instead of using vapor and liquid, you're using liquid and solid. Is that right?
That's exactly it. Yeah.
And how do you modulate the salt concentration in your system?
Yeah, so that's what kept me up at night for a long time. give me flashbacks. We as a society have gotten really good at pushing salt out of water, right? So we used a technique called electrodialysis, and it uses what are called ion selective membranes. I always thought of it as like herding cattle. You basically push the ions in one direction and they get to a certain point, they get to the membrane, and the membrane says, you know, you shall not pass. And then the other type of cattle wants to go the other way, and you trap those as well. And so you basically push them up against a backstop and you trap them, and then you pull them out. And by doing that, we were basically able to put our salt in one compartment and use it to modulate the concentration in the other compartment. In doing so, it melts the solid, creating cold. And then when we're ready to reverse the effect, we reverse the polarity and we tell the ions to go the other way. Our salt doesn't actually participate in the cooling. So the salt that we use doesn't really change its like bonding structure most of the time. Our salt is kind of like a pressure field or an electric field, so to speak, meaning that just the presence of the salt itself is what motivates the solid to become a liquid.
So what advantage does this new cycle, which I understand is called an ionocaloric cycle, what does it have as an advantage over the vapor compression cycle that's used in today's refrigerators?
The big motivation behind any new refrigeration cycle today is to get rid of these harmful refrigerants. So there's a long history of the destructiveness of the refrigerants, both environmentally and, you know, to human health. And, you know, we've been using them for 100 years and we still have not found a suitable replacement. So I think the number one goal of every new, refrigeration cycle that you'll see coming out is to come up with a viable alternative. So right now, most governments are trying to say, you know, let's use heat pumps. Let's heat our homes using electricity. So vapor compression has a harder time going up to high temperatures. So your natural gas boiler, you know, might bring the air up to close to 100 Celsius. A heat pump is going to have a vapor compression heat pump might max out at like 50 to 60 Celsius. And so that makes it unsuitable for a lot of applications on the heating side, which traditionally they never had to face. Now they will. So one of the, key differences for us is that we can operate at those high temperatures without a problem. Going from 0 Celsius to 100 Celsius, for example, that's kind of the sweet spot of some of the materials that we're working with. And so for these new applications that are going to lead to decarbonization, we need these new refrigeration cycles. You know, we're 100 years behind. So hitting efficiency numbers at a very cost-effective way, that's going to be the biggest challenge that, you know, we would need to face. We showed in the paper we published, we spent a lot of time trying to show that the efficiency of this cycle is as good, if not better, in terms of the ideal scenario, as vapor compression. So that means if we have really good engineers that do a really good job, technically this can operate more efficiently than the current method of refrigeration.
Can you talk to me a little bit, just in general terms, about some of the other areas that scientists are exploring in terms of possible alternatives to vapor compression?
Yeah, so there's a big effort going on right now. And so there's been this big dream to make all solid-state cooling. And so what that might look like is you have a material and you apply an electric field and it gets cold. And then you release the electric field and it gets hot. And that's called an electrocaloric effect. So we've spent about 25, maybe 30 years investigating that as a scientific community. The materials that are being used are not quite there yet. There was another really promising cooler called the thermoelectric cooling effect. It was this like incredible promise that came about in 1980, 1990, and then fleshed out a little bit more in the early 2000s. And so in my field, at least, most of the famous professors and whatever made their name in the thermoelectric field. What it is it's a solid material where you apply a voltage. So you apply maybe a few volts and it generates heat on one side and cooling on the other. So which is incredible to think about. It uses electrons as a refrigerant. It basically sends an electron around a material. And on one side, that electron gains energy and the other side, it gives away the energy. And if it worked, I mean, it would have changed everything. And so there was so much money spent trying to get it to be a little bit better. And at the beginning, I think about 20 to 25 years ago, most academics felt like it was within grasp. And they thought in 10, 15 years, the entire world will switch off vapor compression and they're going to use these thermoelectric coolers. It turns out that there was this really, really, really challenging problem, not really an engineering problem, but a fundamental limit that the universe sort of posed. People try getting around it. It doesn't mean that they can't. So there's still new materials that might be able to get around it. But out of the more common materials, and something that like exists today, there's just an impasse. And so there's still hope. But after 20 years of the greatest minds, you know, putting their greatest efforts together, there has not been a competitor to vapor compression on the cooling side.
While there's lots of promising research on the go, scientists like Drew are up against decades of time and money spent perfecting vapor compression. They're also up against the laws of thermodynamics. With the world well on its way to dangerous levels of warming, time is also not on their side. So what do we do about our existing vapor compression tech in the meantime?
There's kind of a whole constellation of people and stakeholders that need to get together and agree on one thing. So like as an example, the US thinks that these new refrigerants called HFOs are kind of like the replacement for the HFCs. So they want that to be the new standard. The EU Germany in particular, just came out with a big study that said HFOs are horrible for the environment. They break down into forever chemicals and they rain down into our water and we can't get those out. And they have other byproducts that are terrible. So they just banned them. And the US hasn't banned them yet. In a perfect world, everyone would be in sync with their approach. I think that a lot of the larger companies are taking it seriously. But at the end of the day, the pressure has to come from above because it's going to cost more money and the performance is going to go down switching off of the HFCs. So if there's just one company out there that doesn't have to do it, then it's like one bad actor will ruin everyone's hopes and dreams because then they're going to sell like hotcakes and no one else can compete. So everyone needs to be in lockstep here. But I am hopeful that there will be some sort of agreement. I don't know what it's going to be though. So I think there needs to be something big that happens in the next 10 years, either from a research point of view or from an industrial political point of view. But I haven't seen that happen yet.
I think this is 100% a place for government involvement. And actually, in the developing world where countries are developing cold chains from scratch, they have been encouraged by the UN to develop a national cooling strategy. So several countries have now done this. This is UN sort of advice. And be strategic about how they are going to encourage energy efficiency, ensure that this doesn't lead to land grabbing and displacement of smallholders, you know, thinking about what they want this to do to their cities. Do they want to avoid the sort of supermarketization of their food system? So being strategic like that is being written into national cooling strategies. I think the U.S. should have a national cooling strategy. I mean, we are still building cold chain here. It has been left to private industry forever and seen as a private business outside of food safety concerns. But I think it is a piece of national infrastructure. I mean, we're reliant on it for our food supply. The citizens surely have an interest in that. If it fails, or it's not resilient, or it's not able to keep pace with climate change, then we all lose. And so I would advocate for a national cooling strategy in the developed world, too. Yes, we have a cold chain already. It's owned by private enterprise. They are working on what private enterprise does, which is a profit basis. But I think that doesn't mean that the government can't regulate it for security, for resilience, and for climate impact.
Nicola Twilley is the co-host of the podcast Gastropod and the author of the forthcoming book about refrigeration, The Birth of Cool. Drew Lilly is a refrigeration researcher at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory at the University of California. You've been listening to Spark. The show is made by Michelle Parisi, Samarui Yohannes, Matt Muse, and me, Nora Young, and by Jonathan Rees, Drew Lilly, and Nicola Twilley. Follow Spark on your favorite podcast app, and you can find us on Facebook, where we are Spark CBC. I'm Nora Young. Talk to you soon.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.